begin now. I have you can't see, but on the floor behind me, I have stacks of stuff I want to get to. When we finish this, I guess another 20 classes. Maybe we'll have to have a class just to all the things we never got to, because I mean all sorts of stuff. Hopefully next week I'll get to Ayurveda, the Gra and Vaila, Cohen marrying converts stuff. I have stuff going back 10 weeks already. Which I'll get to, but in the meantime, we'll spend, as I said, 15 minutes. There's a number of things, and I want to talk, including getting back to a grammatical point, but just a few things that I mentioned last class, and I want to share with you because when I mention it, it's not always clear what I'm referring to. So let me show you some things here. Share the screen here. I meant we talked about that interesting letter of Rav Avraham Yosef, and I mentioned a case, a similar case in Israel. Just so you know what I'm talking about. Sfat rabbi convicted of rape for sex therapy. This was a he was a well-known religious Zionist figure, and he was using his position for, you know, he's a Kabbalist, so he had all sorts of things that he wanted. Jews. So that's what I was referring to last class. I mentioned the Rambam, just so you know I'm talking about last week. We'll get to this in a second. If you look in Hilchos Shabbos, Perek Yud Tes, that's where the Rambam speaks about you can go out on Shabbos in a public domain wearing a locust egg, a fox tooth, etc., a nail from the gallows of an impaled convict, all these sorts of things, which he thought were Bava Maisas, but since the people thought that they were valuable, it's no longer considered carrying them. And that's when he uses the interesting language of an untested amulet. Because what does that mean? A tested, untested? The Rambam didn't believe in amulets. But that's what I was referring to. Okay. A couple other things. I mentioned last class the issue of Rav Soloveitchik, the famous passage in Halachic Man. Those who want to see it, it's in the English translation I have here, pages 60 on. That's where he tells the story. The famous story of the Baal Tokeya, who's a Chabad Chassid, who's weeping, and my father turned to him and said, "Do you weep when you take the lulav?" And then he goes on for the next couple of pages explaining what the Kabbalistic perspective, as seen in Shneur Zalman, the Tanya, has a completely different perspective. He explains why, for the Chabad perspective, he says, "The shofar weeps, wails, and moans over the infinite distance that separates the cosmos from the Ein Sof." But then he explains that the halachic man doesn't make these distinctions between the lulav and the shofar, and that's how he ends. Halachic man does not wish to free her or himself from this realm. I actually have checked the Hebrew. I guess it says her there in the Hebrew as well. And that's how he ends it. And there's no question that Rav Soloveitchik expresses his agreement here with halachic man. I received a couple of interesting emails. First, I one if he wants to know where the Ram. I mentioned that the Ram that the Rav was challenged on this because the Rambam speaks about the shofar, how important it is to bring us, you know, to tshuva and all this. And someone says he looked in Hilchos Shofar. He doesn't see what I'm talking about. Well, you know, I also went and I looked in Hilchos Shofar. And you're right. There's nothing in Hilchos Shofar, even at the end, where the Rambam usually adds Musar type stuff. It's only pure halachic stuff. But what I was referring to is not in Hilchos Shofar. It's in Hilchos Tshuva. If you look in chapter 3, halacha 4, just reading the English translation, that when you hear the shofar, it says, "Wake you up. Wake up, you sleepy ones, from your sleep, and arise, inspect your deeds, repent, etc., etc." So that's where the Rambam speaks about this. Rabbi Isaac Rice from Long Island reminded me of something interesting. But before I get to that, let me tell you what he told me, which I did not know. And this, I think, relates to what David Eisen said. It could actually be the same story that David told us, just a different version. In his book, Or HaMoedim, page 454, he quotes Rav Shlomo, Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, the great important Gadol who just passed away. If you read this foreign blog, you have seen the letter I published from Zalman Nechemya about Rav Gorin that created a bit of a stir. In fact, the Rabbinic Journal HaMayan asked me, could they reprint this, this letter, because it is really an amazing letter by Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg about Rav Shlomo Goren. Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg was like between the Haredi world. Actually, I take that back. He wasn't between the Haredi world and the religious Zionist world. He was in both worlds at the same time. How could he be in both worlds? I don't know, but he was. He writes as follows. That speaking, he gave about his father-in-law. He gave a whole long essay there about his father-in-law. He says, once on Rosh Hashanah, I told him that I saw in a certain book a story with a great man. He doesn't tell which book it is, but we know it's Ish Halacha, who was the Makri, and the Baal Tekeya was a Hasidic Jew, and he was crying. And the Adam Gadol rebuked him and said, why are you crying? He says, do you cry before you eat matzah? It's actually, the Halacha man doesn't actually say matzah, it says lulav. He says, before doing a mitzvah, you're not supposed to cry. And then he says as follows, my father-in-law had great pain of this the whole Rosh Hashanah. How can you take away from someone's feeling of a mitzvah? And then he says, and I also had great pain that I told him this. But Rabbi Rice also reminded me of something else, which I had forgotten, that if you look in Rav Herschel Schechter's book, Mipnine HaRav, page 163, he quotes Rabbi Jachter, Chaim Jachter from Teaneck, as saying that in 1984, Rav Soloveitchik said that he does not agree, who eno maskim im gishat aviv hagon Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. He doesn't agree with his father's view. His father's perspective here that Mitzvah Tekiya Shofar is just like Netivah Sulav. And then he explains that by Shofar, there's a Kiyom Shebalev. So in other words, but you can have this these feelings. So what to make of this? You could say that this is a support for David Singer and Moshe Sokol's view that when the Rav portrays this halachic man, he's not identifying with it. I don't think that's the case at all, though. I think the Rav published Halacha Man in 1944, I think it is. This is 40 years later. We all know that the Rav, as he aged, mellowed. And I think that the Rav, as an older man, he was much more sympathetic to the idea that you should have feeling in the mitzvah of shofar. That's how I would explain it. In fact, I Googled this to see if anyone spoke about it. All I came up with was something by Stanley Boylan from Jewish Action on the Rav of the significance of shofar. And you read all about the Rav and what he thought the shofar is. There's no way in the world he could have agreed with Moshe Soloveitchik, but that's later on. I have no doubt. To me, it is impossible that the Rav did not agree when he wrote Halachic Man with what he wrote. You could have a different perspective. That's how I see it. And one more point on this, though. Rabbi Yaleib sent me something that Rav Aaron Soloveitchik wrote. I actually knew what Rav Aaron Soloveitchik wrote. I didn't know it. He sent me, I guess, from some website maybe or something. I knew it from this. This is called Yelich Shashuim. It's Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. And here you have not only a defense of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, but I don't even know how to answer it. It's on page 558 to 559. This book appeared appeared a few years ago. This is actually edition two. Edition one, which I also have, it might have been due to me, but I suggested to him that it isn't proper for it to be spread about, because some of the stories in edition one are just so crazy. And I don't leave it at that. But even this volume has some interesting stories. But you learn something from this, first of all, very unusual. Not very unusual, very enlightening. Everyone who read Halachic Man assumed that the story took place in Chaslovich. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik was the Rav in Chaslovich. That's where Soloveitchik grew up. And that was a Chabad town to a certain extent. That's where Soloveitchik had his Chabad Muhammad. However, when you read Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, you see that the story took place in Washington Heights. He tells the story. The story took place at Beis Medrash HaGadol on 175th Street. And the Baal Tekeya was a man by the name of Avram Radin. He calls him a big Baal Bechi. They see he would cry a lot. And he tells the story that before he started to blow the shofar, he started to cry, and my father didn't like it. And here, actually, he quotes it as saying, so I don't know, maybe there's another version floating around out there, but he quotes him as saying that when you eat matzahs, do you cry? And he does the whole story there. But then he goes further. He explains what's going on here. If you look in Nehemiah, in chapter 8, it tells the story that the people, which if you look in Rashi there, it tells us it's Rosh Hashanah. And the people started crying. And what is here? I think I have it here. I can, oh yes, I'll pull it up here. Where are we now? I'll show you the pasuk. Look in, it's in pasuk 9. The people started weeping. And what did Ezra, and this is Rosh Hashanah, Rashi tells us, and that seems to be Pshat also. This day is holy unto the Lord our God, mourn not nor weep. So here we have an explicit pasuk that on Rosh Hashanah you're not supposed to weep. So Rav Aharon tells us that's the basis. He says to him, if you want to cry when you eat a matzah, that you can. He tells him straight out that you can cry if you want when you eat a matzah. You can't cry on Rosh Hashanah. So now I ask all the people who criticize Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, it's an explicit pasuk in Nehemiah, it seems. Let us leave that aside, and we'll do one more point here, which I think you will find of interest. Let me get to the screen again here. First, I was looking for a sefer, a different sefer, and I pulled out this book I have. It's a Yalkut Sheilot Teshuvot, 13 different volumes of Sheilot Teshuvot in here. And lo and behold, I come across one of the Sheilot Teshuvot is this. Here's the first page. It begins in English, and then it begins as 5 pages in Hebrew. It's a decision from Rabbi Rafal Moldola. He's the predecessor of Rabbi Dweck. If you're watching Rabbi Dweck's very interesting classes, chief rabbi of Spanish and Portuguese congregation in London, and it's all about a chazan who improperly didn't do the shana, and they make it seem like this is the worst thing in the world, and the person who doesn't do the shana properly is acting obstinately against the din and not against the chief rabbi, and they go through the whole thing of how you have to read it properly. You can't say Vesaf Suvo, you have to say Vesaf Suvo, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the first thing I felt was they took it much more seriously then. We spoke about Chabad, and I found some interesting things. First of all, Rabbi Leib sent me something from the late Rabbi Munshine, which said, showed that in Lubavitch, they're not interested in davening with proper grammar. In Kriya Satora. But then I found something, I just found it on my own. In the Chabad has a journal called Hiskashus. And if you look in 2008, Parshas Lech Lecha, it says as follows, that, and this relates to what David told us. We'll go 5 more minutes with this because I think you'll find it interesting. David mentioned, if you recall, as we're leaving, that the Haftorah from last week, let me show you here. Here it is. From this last Shabbos, you have this word at the end here. You see, Pasuk Lamed Aleph? It's pronounced Vekoyei. And that's, although in Hertz it has it Vekovei, wrong. But in all the manuscripts, all the everyone says it's Vekoyei, but it gets complicated because the Mikros Gadolos printed it wrong. I looked in mine, and Torah Tamima prints it wrong. In fact, if you go to the Chabad way to read a Haftorah, they have. Hold on, I. They have it mistaken. So if you look there, it says that the Rebbe himself, apparently he read Haftorahs also, because it says the Rebbe read it Vekovei. Okay, so now you have a problem because the Rebbe is reading it incorrectly. And I understand for Chabad people that's impossible. The Rebbe always has to read it correctly. I don't know why they have this assumption, just because someone told me that one of the Gedolei Yisrael used to read something improperly. He read, he didn't know about the Patach Genuva we spoke about, Gavoach, and things like that. But then if you look in Parshas Va'era, you have a letter from a Chabadnik, and he says that despite this, you cannot establish anything based upon how the Rebbe read, And he says, first of all, we know that the Rebbe wouldn't correct mistakes of his Baal Kori, the Baal Kori we heard reading. And then he explains that, we can understand how this mistake could have been made. Right after that, there's something from the editors saying that that's absolutely not the case. While the Rebbe did not correct the Baal Kori, so you can't assume when you hear something from the Baal Kori that it's correct. When the Rebbe himself read it, that must be the way it is. Okay, so that's the first thing I want to point out to you. The second thing is, I want to mention, is we spoke about the word kol, and that's going to be the last thing I speak about today because I have to clarify something. But let me first say something about the word kol. We have this, hold on a second. We have the Haftorah for Shabbos Nachamu. Now, remember I said you look in, so for example, here's the Koran Tanakh. They distinguish between the, for example, look over here. This is a Kamatz Katan, so it's pronounced kol. This word, incidentally, is pronounced geh, the yud is silent. Then all of a sudden, you have down here. If you notice, actually, hold on a second. If everyone's not on mute, please put yourself on mute. I'm hearing background. So here you have this word right here. It's not v'chol. All the Ashkenazi make mistake on this. I went online. I saw everyone mispronounces it. It's not v'chol. Again, it's v'chal. And with this word, there's no question at all, because this word does not mean all. This means like to means to measure. It's from the root chav vav lamed, not from the word kol, as in all, meaning kalal. So, for instance, I found a very good Ashkenazi Baal Kori. So here, just listen to him as he reads it. And he reads with Sephardic. Look, if you're an Ashkenazi, you can read it kol. But if you're Sephardic, read it Sephardic, that means you pronounce patach, you pronounce kamatz like patach, you have to read that kal. So here he is.
עלות ינהל ממדד בשאולו מים ושמיים בזרת תיקן וחל בשליש.
Okay, so that there's no dispute, no question about. He's right. Then you'll hear everyone, they don't know, they make the mistake. But then I want to, and we'll end with this, the other point I made, which thank you, Suzanne and others. Here is the word we were speaking about, where I said that, and I played for you that the Sephardic tradition is you read that not kolatz motai, you read it kalatz motai. And I played for you Moroccan. I could play you all the Sephardim have this correct. And here is Koran, and it has it as reading it as kol. On the other hand, oops, here is Rinat Yisrael, the sinner. And what do they have it as? They have it as, they distinguish, if you notice, so here, for example, is the Kamatz Katan. Here's Kamatz Gadol. They have it as Kal. If you look at the introduction to the Rinat Yisrael, he tells you that this is the Sephardic tradition, and since Sephardim read it this way, and we now in Israel read it Sephardic, we should read it Kal. I said last class that this is a mistake in Koran. When I said it's a mistake, I thought I meant that they probably didn't put the vowel properly there, because there are some mistakes. I'm wrong on that. This isn't a mistake. This is a decision. Incidentally, this decision is found as well in the new RCA Siddur. Let me tell you what the decision is, and then we'll have to leave it at that because we could spend a lot of time on this, and I don't want to spend any more time. Incidentally, you can look in the, hold on, where is it? I want to show you something here. Here, if you look in Tehillim, where it says Kol or Kol Atzmotai Tamarna, you see in the inside here, it says Beis Bitam Kol Achei Rash. What that means is that you have two times when you have the word Kol with the Kamatz, with this trup on it, the mercha, because every time you have kol with a kamatz, it's connected with the hyphen. So you have it here in one pasuk in Proverbs, the what I showed you before from Yeshayahu, that's a separate word. If you look in the back of the Koran Siddur, he says as follows. There's an essay there by Hanan Ariel who explains exactly why they do that. And it explains that although the Sfardim recite it the way they are, the question is, how should an Ashkenazi who's praying like a Sephardic pronunciation do this? My assumption was, and this is the Rina Yisrael's assumption, is that if you're an Ashkenazi and now you're pronouncing like a Sephardi, you're saying for Kamat, you're saying Patach, then you should be like a Sephardi. And that's exactly what the Tal, the editor of Rina Yisrael, says in the introduction, since Israelis today are doing like Sephardi. What he argues, however, in the Quran is no. That people today, Ashkenazim, who use the Sephardic pronunciation, they're not adopting lock, stock, and barrel, the Sephardic approach. Rather, they're, for certain matters, being Sephardic, and others, they're simply doing what he calls this. He says that the pronunciation of Ashkenazic Jews was brought about together with Lashon HaMudaberet Medina, the Lav Dafka. That is, modern Israelis who are Ashkenazi are not being taught Sephardic. And in a sense, he's right, because they're not being taught the Ayin, they're not being taught the difference, Gimel, let's say, or Kuf, with Kuf and Kaf sound the same. So he says that he rejects this idea that Ashkenazim, he says, Sephardim continue doing it. Ashkenazim, we're not adopting the Sephardic pronunciation. We're just adopting certain things because the state of Israel has determined to do it. But we're not becoming Sephardim. And therefore, he explains that we're not going to adopt this, and Ashkenazim can still go with Kol. And even though the whole Sephardic tradition has this as Kamatz Katan, the Radak, and Minchat Shai, and if you look in the Da'at Mikra, he says that that's what it should be. And Rabbi Breuer agreed with Korin here that we don't need to change it, we can mark it that way. Now, and they even think, Rabbi Breuer even thinks that it should be a Kamatz Katan, not to mention the fact that the Tiberian in Tiberius, see our whole thing of Kamatz Katan and Kamatz Katan goes back to the Sephardi grammarians in Spain. In Tiberius, they didn't recognize this at all. So some want to say that the Ashkenaz pronunciation goes back to Tiberius, which I think is incorrect. In any event, all I want to conclude with this is that it's a machlokes, like much else we're going to see today. And I take back what I said, and thank you, Susanna, for calling attention to Koren, which allowed me to go into it, that Koren's approach is that we are not adopting the Sephardic pronunciation. We're adopting a modern Israeli pronunciation, and Ashkenazim are just adopting some aspects of it. So Sephardim say Kal, but in Yeshayahu, if any of you want to be the Baal Koreh for the Haftarah on Shabbos Nachamu, you have to say, you can't say Kol, you have to say Kal. And when the person corrects you can tell them that this has nothing to do with the word, as we all know it. For that, there's no dispute. Okay, everyone, we're picking up now in the book. We're the Big Tshuva, number 91, page 208, voting. Must you be guided by Torah principles when you vote or not? And the Tshuva of Menashe Klein, remember, we're in the middle of it, that it worked out, Hashkacha Pratis, divine providence, the night before the election, because everyone is, they're all arguing, those who argue these things, they argue from Jewish law, Jewish values, Jewish this, Jewish that, and of course it's a machlokes, so I guess maybe we have to go back to Rabbi Ariyav's approach, right? If it's a machlokes, you can, if it's a derabbanan, and even if minority, if it's not a super minority, goes one way, you can adopt it. I don't think most of us want to go that way, like the Sinai halacha question. However, let's see what Rabbi Menashe Klein says. He says as follows to me. You asked about voting for the government. Do you then have an achrayus, responsibility from the person who is elected? So if you vote for someone, he's going to do halachically improper things. And he says in the second paragraph, the fact that you participate in the elections, it appears that you are connected and your part, you bear some responsibility for what happens from the people that you elect. And you're showing that your connection and your Ezra Tov, a good citizen. And Rabbi Klein says, Ray first raises the question, what's going on here? Aren't we supposed to be, or makes the point, we're supposed to be separated from the non-Jews here. You're going to go and vote, and you say you're going to be a good citizen. And he says, we're supposed to follow what the sages tell us to be separated from them, or actually not just the sages. That we're supposed to be separated. We're going to be a mamlachas kohanim v'goy kadosh and not be part of the nations. So when he says we want to be separated from them. So what is this that you're going to, that this idea that we're going to go vote and be part of? I mean, if you look today in Borough Park, everyone's running around with a Trump flag. They have Trump flags all over. They all got in their cars. They had the Trump rally and very unusual, by the way, for Haredim. I never recall ever Haredim, Maman Orthodox, yes. I mean, you got the yarmulkes with the things, but for Haredim, it's a new phenomenon. But he says he raises the question: what's going on here? This is going to lead to assimilation, and this goes against what we've been taught. On the other hand, he says in the second paragraph, we see that even in Europe, they would vote, and they would, and the great rabbis would encourage people to vote. And if we go against this, if we announce we're not voting, this will create eiva, enmity, especially in this country, which gives freedom. It's a malchus chesed. It's a kingdom of mercy. That's like a common expression in the Haredi world. Even Moshe Feinstein uses it, referring to America as the Malchut Shel Chesed. In previous classes, I pointed out that you'll never see modern Orthodox people use that phrase. I can't imagine the Rav using it because that implies that the Jews are subjects and the ruler is being kind. If you have a different conception of government, that we're all involved. This isn't a dictatorship or a monarchy. This is a government of, by, and for the people. The whole concept of Malchus, Shel Chesed, makes no sense. So he goes on that since it's a Malchus Shel Chesed, therefore you have to do what you can to strengthen it. Therefore, he says, you can't make any general decisions. Everything depends on the place and the time. And to choose the least worst, which a lot of people even today or tomorrow vote based upon what they think is the least worst. And he says it depends on each circumstance. He brings an example by like Yom Kippur. You feed a person non-kosher, you feed a person a little bit at a time. You don't, so he says sometimes you have to do, even if it's not what we prefer, because he doesn't believe in voting in theory, but we have to. So it's the least worst alternative. But then he says, "Vada imish ma shelyelech b'darchei Torah who kodem o'enu lech b'darchei Torah muamad." He says, if there's a person who's going to go against the Torah, you don't vote for him. You should vote for the one who's going to be more in line with the Torah. How do you determine who's more in line with the Torah? Well, that's, he says, you need a chacham for that, because one person could be against the Torah in this way, for the Torah in the other way. We already started. Rabbi Drash sees this all as irrelevant. And then he says, and he says, you have to look, this person is going to violate a Darabonin. This is going to violate a Daraisa. He says, Dovar Kazeb Emes Lidoli Hador. This has to be given to the great Torah sages. They will be able to tell you, they'll be able to distinguish. And this is like in Europe, he says, Hayub Emes Kovim Bazegadoli Yisrael. In Europe, the great rabbis would determine what to do. Now, this clearly reflects a Haredi perspective that Das Torah, that the rabbis, the great rabbis, are the ones to make these decisions. Now, in a sense, this is all a fiction for many, because if you go to Israel, for instance, you go to completely Haredi towns, you'll find plenty of people who are not voting for Shas or Agudas Yisrael or Degor Torah or any of them. They're voting for Likud, and they're voting for every party. So many people don't take this entirely seriously, but this is a position that on important issues like who to vote for, this is something you need to go to the great rabbis, and particularly in Hasidic circles, even if they don't publicly declare, like this year, they came out pretty publicly, but it always was apparent who the great rabbi supported. And that's why politicians go to meet with these Hasidic rabbis, because they can, if the rabbi of Meishel says who to vote for, no one's gonna listen. But if the Hasidic rabbi says who to vote for, he can pull many votes. He can pull 10,000 votes, if you're more, even if you're Satmar, but all the Hasidic groups have great influence. Look, it's a very illiberal position, and it's hard to imagine anyone listening to these classes could ever adopt such a position, that your vote's going to be determined by what a rabbi says. In fact, I'm very good friends with someone from Lakewood, and he actually is a big Biden supporter, which is unusual because most people in Lakewood, it's probably going to be 85% Trump. But I said to him, you know, Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky gave his Das Torah that you have to go for Trump. So he says, is this the first, he said to me, is this the first time you're holding by Rav Shmuel's Das Torah? So, of course, they can only give this Das Torah as an individual private citizen, not as a member of the Moetzes Gedolei Torah of the Aguda, because it's, I assume Aguda is nonprofit, right? As a nonprofit, you can't endorse. But that's what he says. And he says you have to vote, because if you don't, maybe someone worse will come in. And he cites a proof from a Gemara that in Sota, that in the days of the Romans, the Jews had to send a sacrifice to be offered on the on their festival. So they paid money that they could send it the day before. So the sacrifice was still offered, but it wasn't on the festival. And then they were able to arrange that they'd send it. It's no longer alive. It's already slaughtered. So the result, what the Gemara is showing you, is that sometimes you're in a difficult situation. You try to lessen the severity of any infraction. And that's his point here, that really we would not want to be in this situation, but under circumstances, we have to vote for all sorts of reasons. Therefore, it should be for the person who's going to be more in line with Torah. And how to determine that? You have to ask the rabbis. I don't think it's as crazy as it sounds for many, because I think many people also are going to vote and they're saying, what's in line with ethical values? Isn't that Torah values? That's not so. So Rabbi Klein, he's not just thinking the way you might be thinking in terms of broader ethical things. He's looking more at technical halachic things. Will he permit abortion, etc.? But the idea that you have to be guided by moral ethical values, that's no different than saying you have to be guided by Torah perspectives. And perhaps that position is closer to what Menashe Klein is saying than the position that you don't need to be concerned about these things at all. So that's his position. This Rabbi Aryeh Klapper from outside of Boston, from Sharon, he has an institute every summer, Beis Medrash, for very talented college students, where they come and they did it by Zoom this year, but they would come for a couple of weeks and they focus on Jewish issue, Jewish law and philosophy, how it deals with issues of the day. This year, he dealt with ideas of citizenship, as reflected in rabbinic sources. And he actually studied this tshuva as one of the things, he told me they studied it as one of the approaches to how to deal with citizenship. Obviously, when you look at, say, a Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, and the German Gedolim, how they view what it means to be a citizen. It's very different than someone who comes from Hungary, and Jews were never really welcome, never part of society in that way. But that's the tshuva. This is followed, and this is a completely separate tshuva, the next one, but this is also, to me, 1988. And I turned to Rav Menashe Klein because I found two interesting passages. And I wanted to hear his opinion on them, his perspective. In Rav Meir Don Plotsky's, Meir Don Plotsky, the author of the Klei Chemda, a very interesting perush on Chumash, in my blog post, not the last one, I think it was the one before, I found in one of his works, he describes how when he came to New York, he gave a shiur at Yeshivas Rav Yitzchak Chanan. But Rav Meir Don Plotsky is regarded as a, you know, one of the great Polish Gedolim. He, along with one or two others, but he in particular was one of the people who exposed the Yerushalmi Kudshim, the Yerushalmi on the Order of Kudshim as a forgery. He even wrote a whole book on this. So, and in rabbinic circles, he just referred to him as Rav Meir Don Plotsky. So he says at the end of Mishpatim, the first section, he's speaking about going to the idea of secular courts, Jewish courts. He then has in brackets, he says that none of this makes a difference according to law, because everything I said that you're not supposed to go to the courts of the land that you have to go to Beis Din only applies to the Shoftim, doesn't apply to the Shoftim Bizmanenu, it doesn't apply to the courts in Poland that we have, and they're not our kos. And you have to regard them as it's Dina the Mahusadina. But I'm referring, when I speak about not going to the courts, the secular courts, Medinos Rechokos, those faraway states, countries like China and Japan, She'ovdim Sham Akum, V'yesham Din Rechaz, because there they worship idols. And now this is a common thing that at the beginning of books, they always say, anytime I make a negative comment about the nations among whom we live, it's not referring to the nation, the Christian world, it's only referring to those pagans out in India or China or Japan, Dafka, the ones who were not anti-Semitic. That's the, so I asked Rabbi Klein, even I knew he would say about, but I wanted to hear him say it. The next one's not so clear. I said, what do you make of this? How could Rameir Don say that there's no inyan of going to the secular courts? It's incredible because when you look around today, when Hasidic Rebbes and others in have a machokis, they dafka take it to the secular court. Can you imagine a bigger chil Hashem than when Hasidic Rebbes are fighting over who should be the Yerusha? They go to the secular court. So they claim that they can't find a Beis Din that's going to be impartial, which if they just go to the RCA Beis Din, the RCA Beis Din is impartial, obviously, but they won't go that because that's obviously the RCA Beis Din is possible. They're Zionists and things like that. So they have to go to Hasidic Beis Din. And maybe they're right. Any Hasidic Beis Din they're going to go to is going to have a connection to one of them. And but God forbid they go to outside their Hasidic world. So instead, they go to the secular courts. In fact, I think it was the Bubbaverse, when they were at the secular court, the judge said, you should not be here. You should be at Beis Din. So, I mean, that's an unbelievable Chil Hashem. But, and how can you blame the people for going to court when the rabbis are doing it? So Rabbi Menashe says that this is only written because of the fear of the non-Jews. Just like always at the beginning of a book, you'd say, anytime it says goy, it's referring to the ones in the earlier years, not the ones among who we live, and that's because of the censor, and that's true. There's no question that he is right about this. When they were speaking about, for example, the status of Christianity, sometimes they'll refer to it as, they'll speak about, they'll speak in code. They'll speak about different halachot, which they didn't want to speak publicly about because it create enmity. Rabbi Menashe is absolutely right about that. But then I sent him another passage, and that's the famous Aruch HaShulchan. That if you you were in my classes on the Aruch HaShulchan, we discussed this at length, where the Aruch HaShulchan in Siman Shin Pei Chet speaks about, he's not referring to our house judging, he's referring to Masira. That is, can you inform on, and Masira is in the news also, because what happens if some guys, they come in your shul and they're not wearing masks? The Vizhnitzer Rebbe just said that if you inform on a synagogue that, let's say, they're letting people in without masks, you're a moser, and it's the worst thing in the world, being a moser. So that's like a terrible thing. And throughout history, Jews have never wanted to turn in other Jews to the non-Jewish government. The Aruch HaShulchan says, however, that only applied in an era when the governments were not really led by any sorts of justice. It was just, it was corrupt. But for when you deal with just, and he says, like today in certain African countries where, you know, you just have to pay people off. But he says, not true when it comes to the European countries. And in particular, Adonenu Hazar Mirusia, our master, the Tsar, and his forefathers. And then he says, Mahe Britannia and England, that England spreads out its government to all the lands all over, and they protect people. And rich people don't need to hide themselves because they're protected. And therefore, he says, all the whole din of Masira doesn't apply in those places. Whereas when there's no valid government, if you're moser someone, that he could lose all his money, he could lose his life, etc. What to do about this? Well, first let me say that this Aruch HaShulchan is not clear at all. You can always dismiss this Aruch HaShulchan as for the censor, but and there have been many, and I'm not sure what's correct. This was a big dispute because there was this guy from France who killed, I think it was, he killed someone, and then he escaped to Israel, and he was arrested, and they wanted, France asked for an extradition. And Israel, he went to the Supreme Court, and Justice Menachem Elon, who was also a big Talmid Chacham, he wrote a long decision, which is really a responsum, and he cited, among others, this Aruch HaShulchan to say that there's no problem handing over a criminal to France, even from a pure halachic standpoint, because he'll be judged. It's a civilized society. Rav Shaul Yisraeli wrote in response that he's being naive. Menachem Elon, this is what the Aruch HaShulchan means. Aruch HaShulchan is just speaking to the censor. However, the Tzitz Eliezer takes the Aruch HaShulchan seriously. I assume the Tzitz Eliezer's point is that what do you need a he wouldn't have to mention England. Fine, maybe the czar is for the censor, but when he refers to England, he doesn't have to mention England. He's speaking really about the situation where you have a government that's going to judge someone properly. And this is really, I don't need to get into it now. You can go back online to the Aruch HaShulchan classes, but this becomes a dispute between the more modern Orthodox rabbis and the more in the Haredi world in terms of Masira. You can hear, I think Rav Schechter's also even said it, that there's no Masira in America. And others have pointed out, you know, this isn't Masira. The whole idea of Masira assumes that it's us versus them, that, you know, the duke or the prince or the king, whatever, he's taking all our money. And therefore, if I inform on someone, I'm causing the money to be stolen. But we don't have that. It's the government of the people. If someone is stealing or doing something wrong, he's also stealing from me. And we're in a different type of system. So the whole, and this came into play during the sexual abuse. People said you can't turn them in because it's Masira. And I mean, it's basically a dispute. And we're going to see later what Rabbi Greenblatt or Moshe Malka say. But I don't want to get into that as much because that's not the issue today. Just to let you know that this Aruch HaShulchan, there's a long history of how to relate to this Aruch HaShulchan. But Rabbi Klein says, Chas v'shalom. God forbid, even assume for a moment that the Aruch HaShulchan thought that there's no din of Masira in England. And he goes off, he gives, he talks about how there's, we see today, people are taking them, others to secular courts. And even though it's a Malchus Shel Chesed, it causes them all sorts of problems. And he cites the Gemara to support that you can't, even if it's at least in those days, a decent, you still can't be a moser. Okay, this is really an ideological perspective, not so much halachic, because if you view modern governments the way at least the Aruch HaShulchan describes it, leaving aside whether he really meant it, then it's not Masira. It's the government is going to take care of enforcing the law, which you can enforce the law. This whole Masira thing with the sexual abuse is always so, I always found it very strange. They say that someone is sexually abused, so you can't call the government because it's Masira. You got to go to the rabbis. So what does that mean? So if someone breaks in my house, he's going to rob me, I have to call the rabbi and ask her, can I report him? If you rape my wife, I need to go to the rabbis and ask her. And they never would say that. But with the kids, for some reason, there was such a blind spot. Then all of a sudden, it's Masira. It's if someone comes in and shoots my family up, I have to go to the rabbi before I go to the government because it's Masira. Based on that logic, of course you do. But that no one has that. That makes no sense. And no one in history has ever said that if someone comes and shoots, and comes into my house and threatens my family and kills my brother or something, I need to go to the rabbi to say, can I go to the, report him? I shouldn't say no one said. We do have cases well, years ago where the rabbi said, even murder, we'll handle it in our own community. But they handled it. But today the rabbis have no authority. So, but that's what he holds. You get a good reflection here of a posek from a very closed circle who really doesn't feel part of America, very much a guest. So you get a different perspective. The next responsa we're up to is 93, page 210. And this is, take us back to Morocco now. Here he is, Rav Moshe Malka. Chief Rabbi of Petach Tikva. We had a number of questions of his earlier in the semester. He was rabbi in based in Casablanca, comes to Eretz Yisrael in 1967, becomes a chief rabbi of Petach Tikva, has six volumes of Tshuvot Mikveh Hamayim, and one volume, I don't know why he changed the name, his last volume of responses is called Veheshiv Moshe. And this is appears from Veheshiv Moshe in the second, there's two volumes of Veheshiv Moshe in the second, well, two volumes he published. One is Veheshiv Moshe, the other is his Drashos, but he also has notes on the Torah Tamima, if anyone's interested in Torah Tamima. So I asked him a few questions. This is 1991, where I was working, already working at Brandeis, and I'm giving classes. I would come once a week, and I'd give a shiur there. And he begins by saying, so the first question was, you'll see from the answer to the question. He says, it's good that you're mazakeh sarabim, but fatzas Torah bein studentim, that you're teaching Torah to the students. My question was as follows. We know that there's a principle of mutav shiushogim. That is, if you know people are not going to listen to a certain halachot, you're not supposed to say them publicly. You're not supposed to do it because it's better that they don't know it than that they know it and violate it. And some rabbis have written about if the rabbi learns Shabbos morning that the Erev is down and all the women have pushed their baby carriages and all sorts of things, don't announce the Erev is down because there's no way really to solve this problem. They're not going to listen and it's better that they don't know. When this applies, this principle of Mutav Shushogin applies in many cases. One of my claims, incidentally, is that the reason we've seen the various chumras in the last generation, well, there's a lot written about it, even rupture and reconstruction, Chaim Soloveitchik wrote about it. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that the people, when you look at a Rav Moshe Feinstein, for instance, he's deciding for people of different backgrounds who, even Rav Avad Yosef, you'll see expressions like better that they be unwitting sinners, better that they, we can rely on this kula because it's too hard otherwise, that they might not listen to us. You have all these expressions. We can't, we can't establish halacha the way we'd like to, so we have to go with leniencies. But if you're Revel Yashiv, or you're in B'nai Brak, and you're postulating for a completely yeshivish environment, those principles never come into play. That all the posting throughout history have used, what a mutav shogin. That they're going to listen to whatever you tell them. So you never have this idea that, well, we won't tell them this. We're relying on a lenient opinion because they'll do whatever you tell them. So therefore, you can strive for greater levels of stringency because whatever you tell them, they'll listen to. That's very different than a post-secular Rav Moshe because, what do you mean? He could say things, you're not going to listen to it because they're balabatim, and balabatim don't listen to everything. So you need to know what you can say and what you can say. Every post-sec until the modern times deals with this issue. There's this dialectic between what you can say and what the people will accept. It's only in the modern day when you have Haredi communities. You never before had Haredi communities. Such a concept never existed. We say in Rosh Hashanah, right? Or Yom Kippur, we ask the permission to pray with sinners. But seriously, you never had this idea of a Haredi community. The closest you ever had was in a yeshiva. They were daven together, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. But you never had a community of just yeshivish types who were completely pious in all these areas. You always had communities which had all sorts of people. And therefore, and I'm talking every single century, look in the Rambam, the issues he had to deal with. And of course, look in the Gemara as well. So this is a, people don't realize this is a completely new phenomenon, either l'shvach or l'gnai. It's your own opinions. Some people don't think it's so good because communities are supposed to have all types. Others think it's great because now we can finally reach levels of halachic observance that we never had before. But so the question is, though, what am I supposed to do when I'm teaching? Because I saw that Rav Yosef Nassas says that when you teach, you have to teach everything. You don't skip when you're teaching. When you give, let's say, an announcement, or let's say you give a drush or something, then you don't tell people something that you don't think they're going to listen to. You just tell, like, maybe a few people. But Rav Yosef Masas says that when you actually are, let's say you're running Shulchan Aruch, you're going siman after siman, that you don't skip. If the people don't, you know, because look, you have to teach the halacha. If they don't want to listen, they're not going to listen. That's different than, you know, getting up and making an announcement. And he says as follows. He says, you should go according to the Seder and Shulchan Aruch. Don't skip any halachot unless you see that it's not, today we don't, it's not relevant. For example, Siman Gimel and Aruch Chaim and Shulchan Aruch, there's some things dealing with going to the bathroom. Today we have modern bathrooms, so it's irrelevant. Or he says Siman Lamed Beis, which deal with how to write tefillin. That's not something you need to, you know, if you're sitting and you're studying, going through Shulchan Aruch, that's for specialists. You don't need to teach the average person that. But other than that, when you're reading something, the fact that you think people don't know about it, let's say you know in your community people are violating a certain thing about Shabbos, and yet you're giving a shiur, you're going through Aruch Chaim, and you get up to that siman, don't skip that siman. You're supposed to do it. And then he says, regarding mutav shiur shogegin, he says this idea that better they be unwitting sinners. He says this only applies if you know. What does know mean? I guess very certain that they're not going to listen. But if you're teaching Torah, you have to teach everything, even if you know they're not going to listen. If I'm giving a shiur, I have to go through everything, because they'll never know then what's permitted and what's forbidden. Then, yes, I had asked him a different question. I don't know why I asked him this question. I asked the same question to Rabbi Ephraim Greenblatt. We'll see a different perspective than we saw from Moshe Klein. It must have been something in the news. And I was wondering, are you allowed to send maybe something I saw, maybe a movie, who knows, that an undercover, how do they catch drug dealers? Undercover, they buy the drugs or they sell the drugs, and that's how they get them. Is that leaf naive here? Is that putting a stumbling block before the blind? If I have a wire, or I'm given drugs and I stand on a street corner and I sell it, and people come to buy it, and then we arrest them, is that, is that Moser? If with Jews, am I guilty of Masira? And second of all, is that leaf naive, putting a stumbling block? I'm giving the opportunity for the person to buy it, and then he buys it. Yeah, maybe you could say he could buy it somewhere else, but he wouldn't buy it today, maybe. He might not buy it till next week. Maybe he won't ever buy it, but I'm standing on the street corner or any other similar thing. So is that a violation? And this is obviously something that it's not so relevant in America, but if you're in the state of Israel, you're trying to create a society that follows Torah, let's say, and definitely the religious Zionists, they have a journal, an annual, Tzohar, they used to have called HaTorah VaMedina. They dealt with all these questions and how to determine how halachic society should function. You need to know, how should a police force function? And this is obviously vital. There's other matters, how police force functions. You know, when you arrest someone, let's say you're called on Shabbos, you arrest someone, what are you supposed to do? What's he supposed to do? Can you write up a report? Can you drive him back to the police station? But this is also an issue. There's been a lot written about this. So then he says, I wrote a whole tshuva, and he does. He has 3 pages or 2.5 pages dealing with this matter. And then Rabbi Ephraim Greenblatt, we're going to see what he says as well about it. But I see it's already 9:25, so I'd rather do this whole tshuva at one time. Because it flows and it's a long tshuva. But we do have a minute here, so maybe I'll... Let me tell you, no. So then, you know, I'm going to wait till next week, and I'm going to, because by the time I get the questions, usually the questions go on for 15, 20 minutes. We'll get to that. Another question is, then we get into other issues. The Rambam's view of demons. Leaving settlements. What's the Torah view about prisons? How to establish Torah in Medina Yisrael. And then we will finish with Dat u'Medina, the section Dat u'Medina. And we're going to start with Tikkun Soferim, dealing with all sorts of interesting things. But although some of them are technical, but they have all sorts of implications. For example, Simam Kuf, the first one, I deal with the translation of the Arabic word Itikad. that has all sorts of implications on is belief in God a mitzvah? Wait till you see the machlokas here, whether belief in God is a commandment and can you command belief in God? It goes back to that. Oh, and before we finish next week, well, I'll talk a bit about this word dot, that so-called that Hebrew word, which really is a Persian word, apparently. And what about Eish dot in the Torah? So we'll deal with all this next class because it's already 9:26. So let me look at the questions. After Tikkun Sofrim deals with all sorts of interesting things about books and rabbis. No more halacha. There's hashkafa. There's all sorts of lots of good stuff. But first, let me get to the questions here, comments. And again, I apologize. I see I ended 4 minutes early. I could have maybe gotten, but we'll get to it. I have a lot. I still have to get to Amori as well. Wait till you see what I show you from a sefer dealing with Amori. Love. Baruch says the Arizal thinks highly of crying in Rosh Hashanah, but the Gra came out squarely against it. Some rabbis have tried to reconcile the positions between tears of joy and tears of sadness. So on Rosh Hashanah, it would be tears of joy. Well, the story with the Rav is tears of fear of the moment, the emotional moment, etc. Okay, I wasn't being mocked at on the Nassau Gachor. We have this. If it says Kovei, it's mistaken. It's Koyen. Nassau Gachor is. So for people getting Aliyah, a lot of people make a mistake about it, especially Israelis. They get the Aliyah, they say Baruchus Hashem. Often they say Baruchus Hamdorach and Hamavarach. But then they say Baruch Hashem Akinmecham Asher. So it's not. If you look in the Siddur, there's that little line, the Metag. But the Metag in the Siddur is not the Metag in the Chumash. Metag in the Siddur is where you put the accent. It's Asher Bachar Banu Mekol Mi V'Nasan Lanu. Because the reason that is because the next word, Asher Bachar Banu, it's not Banu, build, it's Banu. So since you have the accent on the first syllable in Banu, then normally it would be Bachar. So the accent goes to the first. You push it back. So it's Bachar Banu. This is not, even in Torah reading, you don't correct this. I don't know, Avi, what you're referring to as the grammarians differ, whether to read a Shvan or not, what you're referring to. Yes, obviously, Baruch, I realize the questions with the Chabad doctrine of Rebbe infallibility, but I think it's interesting that in the Hiskashra, someone even writes in and says, we can't assume just because the Rebbe said it that we're going to establish it based on that. He seems to be saying that the Rebbe just picked up whatever tikkun he had, whatever Haftarah book he had, and read it that way. Furthermore, it's pointed out that in the... Hold on, in that case or in a different case, one of the Chabad Haftorah books is actually different than what the Rebbe said. Rabbi Kalman, I believe I heard in the name of the Rav quoting the Gra that one could cry during davening, but not afterwards. Would be. Yes, thank you, Esther, the Radak. It's Koye. It's there's no question it's Koye. If my voice is not here, I'm not sure if it's on my side. It says Mincha Shain Haftar is clear that the word is Koye, but amazingly enough, if you happen to own Masadar of Cook's recent Das Ezra Chumash with Ibn Ezra and Pershim Ezra, you will see that they have the word vocalized Vekove. Interesting about the Ibn Ezra, the Mincha Shai thought that the Ibn Ezra might have thought it was Vakove because he makes a comment on Tehillim, but there's no connection. The same word appears in Tehillim, and there it's Vakove. Baruch says, is Rav Nasha Klein go against the position of his teacher, the Koisenberger Rebbe, regarding voting? I don't know. Now Baruch, you got me here on one. I pronounce it Klei Chemda. It's actually Klei Chemda. Technically, that's correct. Sometimes I have my yeshivish pronunciation. I have the what I believe perhaps is the only the zechus to make, have had Professor Tur make Professor Tursky laugh. If you knew who Professor Tursky was, Yitzhak Tursky, he did not laugh. He was a very serious person. I got him to laugh, or at least smile. How did I get him to? Because he would always ask me to read. I don't know why he asked me to read, but I wasn't the only one, but I was often the reader. We would read texts, all these interesting texts, Fodi, Crescas, et cetera, et cetera. And he would always correct my pronunciation. So once I come in, I'm going to show you what I showed him. Here it is. In 1990, this book came out. This is it's Or Hashem of Rav Chassidai Crescas. And it's vocalized. It has as Archibald says, vowelized. So I got it at Big Eisen. It has the Big Eisen mark, and I brought it in, and he asked me to read. We were reading Chassidai Crescas. Chassidai Crescas, the great Spanish scholar, great philosopher. He was also a halachist, but he never wrote his halachic work. So I said to him, you're not going to be able to correct my pronunciation. And he said, why? I said, because I got a new edition of Or Hashem. And he said, so? I said, it's menikid. So anyone from a yeshivish background, menikid, menukad. So he actually laughed about that. Someone privately texts me that the most recent episode of Headlines is about Moser. Rabbi Kelman says a Rosh Hashanah Zalman held it's a mitzvah today to ensure thieves go to jail. That is true. They came to Rosh Hashanah Zalman about Pidyon Shvuyim to get someone out of jail. And Rav Shlomo Zalman asked what he did, and he explained the crime he did. So Rav Shlomo Zalman's answer, this is famous, was that he should sit in jail for a while so he learns not to do the crime again. And Rav Moshe had no problem to be a prosecutor, even as he will need to prosecute other Jews. Well, it goes back to this. We'll see from Moshe Malka, he quotes. The Gemara speaks about one of the Amoraim or Tanaim, I forget now, who was involved with this. Orach says that certain so-called Haredim that are frauds do various improper things and hide behind Masira and the like when people stand against them. Many cases, unfortunately, when they violate zoning, hurt neighbors' property, swindle, steal, they're not Haredim, they're reverse Maranos, dress as Jews and act much differently. Frauds from the era of Rav. That's true. It is true that there have been cases where that's a way, unfortunately, because Masira is such a terrible thing in that community. If you want to scare someone, you can get, you use Masira as a way to prevent them from really getting justice. And it's a problem. But I just want to say, though, and I'll end with this, that we have a problem in the modern Orthodox community. I know we have plenty of people here who aren't listening who are not in the modern Orthodox community, but I can say in the modern Orthodox community, we have people who just don't even go to Beis Din. I understand the Haredim don't go to Beis Din sometimes. When they don't think maybe they can win, I don't know, but then it's a real Chil Hashem. But what about the fact that modern Orthodox community, most people, I think, maybe I shouldn't say most because I don't know, but many people, if it's a Choshen Mishpat question, they won't even think of going to a Beis Din. The first thing they'll do is they'll call, they'll go to a secular court. That's completely wrong. I had a letter, by the way, which I probably should have put in the book and could have translated to Hebrew. I wrote Dr. Lamb a letter asking him about what's the justification for Cardozo having a law school. He's teaching people to be lawyers, and they could then violate halacha. He gave it to Rabbi Blech. Rabbi Blech wrote me a long letter explaining that, which I knew, but I wasn't sure how this would play into it, that most lawyers, as you all know, are not involved in these sort of matters. They're in corporate or they're with Jews and non-Jews. And therefore, you can't say you can't have a law school because some Jews are going to be improper about it. But in the modern Orthodox world, it seems that they won't even consider going to a Beis Din. They'll immediately just go to the secular court. But sometimes it's the other way. When we had a place in Vacation Village in the Catskills, my father had a run-in in his car. He was hit by this guy from this bungalow colony. And so whatever, my father agreed that they go to Beis Din. But then when he calls up, the guy refuses to answer. And and this is from one of the Haredi Blon colonies. And he asked, I believe it was Rav Aaron Kahn, if I'm not mistaken, was the Rav in the summer there. My father called up and spoke to him. And I think it was Rav Kahn. He spoke to the guy and he came back and he said, I don't know what to tell you. He refuses to go to Beis Din. So even in that world, unfortunately, you have people who won't do it. But it is true that in the modern Orthodox world, and not just in the modern Orthodox world, if you look back 100 years ago, you look at the volumes of Tshuvos. In the Sephardic world, you have plenty dealing with Choshen Mishpat. In the Ashkenazic world, very few. Because even in the Orthodox world, people started going to secular courts, and it's not right. There was a claim when the state of Israel was established that people started saying, well, it's not considered secular courts, it's because they're Jews, and it's not true. It's even in Israel, they're regarded at least by the great rabbis as secular courts. So if you have a dispute with your neighbor, what I was told, however, when I asked a shaila once, that if you're in a dispute with a non-religious Jew, you can go to secular court. That is, you don't need to go to a Beis Din to get permission. You don't need to invite him to a Beis Din. And when he refuses to go to Beis Din, then go to secular court. I was told that if you're in a dispute with a non-religious Jew, you can assume from the get-go that he will have no interest in going to a Beis Din. So you can immediately go to secular court. I don't know if all poskim would agree with this. I find it hard to believe that any non-religious Jew would agree to go to a Beis Din. In fact, he probably assumed it would be favored against him, because if it's a religious court and he's not religious, the Beis Din's going to favor the guy with the yarmulke, which isn't true. If it's a reliable Beis Din, they'll even, if it's a non-Jew is correct, they'll give it to the non-Jew. But that's what I was told, that by a non-religious Jew, you don't need to do anything. Another time, Baruch, we can get into that perhaps. I want to thank you all for joining us. I hope next week when we meet, we'll all be safe and everything. And some of you, unfortunately, are in dangerous places, that if the wrong in quote candidate is elected, just be careful and be safe. But other than that, I hope to see you all next week and pick up on the safer. Rabbi Kelman.
All right, thank you. Listen, we live in a crazy world. We before Shlema, I'm sure everybody heard there was a terrorist attack in Vienna. I don't know if they know yet exactly all the details, but and a bunch of gum, I'm sure everybody heard, opened up fire in a whole bunch of locations. Anyways, we live in a crazy world. Let's pray that Oseh Shalom B'Mirmav. What can I say? Anyways, thank you, Mark. My God, if the American election turns into violence, it's the end of the free world. Really, it's can close up shop. And I don't know what to say. Okay, that would be just horrendous. Anyways, want to wish everybody well. Tomorrow, doubleheader, please God, 11 a.m. We're starting our six-part series, An Introduction to Midrash. Simi Peters, that will from Israel, will be giving. She's an expert on Midrash. She's written on it a lot. We'll be giving a series on Midrash, and then at 12:15, Benny Gesundheit, we'll be continuing a series on Sefer Tehillim, and on Wednesday morning, Marty Lakshin, after his two classes on Shadal, will be starting on Moshe Mendelssohn. As we say, biblical commentaries, they didn't teach you in yeshiva. I don't think in JAC they taught you too much about Mendelssohn's Perush on Chumash. Am I correct?
So, that was off limits.
That was off limits, although it's crazy, as whatever, I don't want, no comment, but Mendelssohn, as we all know, was an observant Jew. Whatever his legacy, you know, is, well, come to the classes, we'll discuss that. Okay, and we'll continue all the regular classes during the week. We look forward to seeing you, inviting your friends to come, as I always say, to join us, and everybody be well, be safe, and we should hear good news and good things, and Hakobi de Shemaim. We got to do our part, but let's pray for the welfare of government. Ilmale Shlomo Shemachu Chayim Balo. If you don't have government, stable government, we're all in trouble. So let's pray that we should have a stable government. And since America still is the leader of the world, for better or for worse, whatever it's done, changed, it's for better, believe me, than the other options. You know, we should have a peaceful election. And what can I say from living in Canada? All right, enough of my political commentary, and have a good night.